from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road, A Bible of the Beat Generation, is a fictionalized account of Kerouac and his friend Neil Cassady's journey across the country. Also on that journey was Cassady's young wife, Lou Ann Henderson, fictionalized as the sexy Mary Lou. Kerouac biographer Jerry Nicosia has now rescued Henderson from the margins of beat scholarship in his book One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. We'll talk with Nicosia about Henderson and her indelible impact on the friendship between Kerouac and Cassady and their story of being on the road. It's all coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
A young writer trying to take off. Dean just raced in society. He had just married a 16-year-old chick named Mary Lou.
Now, that was a clip from the trailer for On the Road, a new film adaptation of the beat classic, which is premiering at the Cannes Film Festival later this month. And in this hour, Jack Kerouac biographer and beat historian Gerald Nicosia, who consulted on the new $25 million film, joins us to talk about his new book on the author of On the Road, One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road, which tells the story of Lou Ann Henderson, who was the prototype for the character Mary Lou in Kerouac's famous novel which became a Bible to the beat generation. Gerald Nicosia also edited a book of Jan Kerouac's, Jack's daughter, and helped her in her fight over possession of Kerouac's papers. He's also the author of a book about Vietnam veterans called Home to War, and based on his research and the interviews he conducted with Mary Lou Henderson in 1978, Gerald Nicosia makes the case that she, a 15-year-old girl who Neil Cassady married, was the real link between Kerouac and Cassady and a major force in the making of On the Road, a novel, by the way, that has been translated now into 40 languages. Mm-hmm. Gerald Nicosia joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to see you again. Welcome.
Good to see you again, Michael.
Well, let's talk about the movie first, because it sounds like a pretty good gig. You do a boon camp for all these young movie stars who are doing On the Road. That was to teach them about what the beat sensibility was?
Well, yeah. You know, Walter Salles got the rights from Francis Ford Coppola in 2005. And Coppola had had the rights since 1980, and Coppola couldn't get a decent script written. Coppola had hired numerous people to write scripts, and they all came out bad. He couldn't use them. And so finally Coppola, I guess in despair, handed the rights over to Walter Salles, who had done Motorcycle Diaries, because it's a movie about guys on motorcycles. And supposedly he said, well, if he can do motorcycles, he can do cars too. And but Salles couldn't get funding. I mean, there was the rub. Really interesting. We all talk about how great On the Road is and the seminal novel of the 50s and of the rebels of the 20th century. He couldn't get funding for 5 years. And it was only after he won a major award here in 2010 at the San Francisco International Film Festival. I was there within 2 days after that award was given to him. He got a telegram from this little French company, MK2, and said, we'll fund it, but at $25 million, which is not a lot of money for a major film, as you know. And so at that point, Salles was ready to roll $25 million because there were so many actors that wanted to do this novel, even if they got paid almost nothing. And so they all worked at scale. Kristen Stewart, the Twilight girl, they all worked at scale. And Walter, who had met me in 2005 when he was first researching the book, talked to me and said, would you do a boot camp? Because he had done a boot camp for the actors playing revolutionaries in about Che Guevara in the Motorcycle Diaries. Because he said, again, these are young kids. They know nothing. The beat generation is ancient history. And yes, it was very exciting to be able to go up to Montreal and work with Kristen Stewart and Garrett Hedlund and Sam Riley. And I loved them. I thought they were so dedicated, really committed young people. I just thought they were terrific.
Well, he's got quite a cast. He's got Amy Adams and Viggo Mortensen and Kirsten Dunst and Steve Buscemi. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe you'd get Matt Damon and Ben Affleck because they dedicated a whole movie to Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg.
Well, over the years, many, many of these actors that you mentioned and Johnny Depp all wanted this part, but then gradually they grew too old for the parts because, you know, this thing went on from 1980, this search for the script and for the actors. So he had to, because the movie's about young people. You know, Lou Ann is 16 years old and Cassady is 20 and Kerouac's 23 or something. So, you know, you can't have, some of these actors have just aged out.
So what did you do? I want to get to the real story of your book, which is about Mary Lou and how she provided the glue and really the catalyst for On the Road more than, and really the relationship, as I said, my introduction between Cassidy and Kerouac. But what do you do with young people like that who really are, I use the word advisedly, but ignorant?
Well, I because I did the biography of Jack Kerouac, Memory Babe, I had traveled all over the country. I had 300 interviews on tape. I had thousands of photographs. I mean, I have, over the years, I've gathered a whole trove of materials, and so I brought a lot of that with me up to Montreal. And specifically, Kristen Stewart had asked ahead of time. She's playing the part of Mary Lou, which is based on Lou Anne Henderson, who ironically died about 2 or 3 months before this whole thing began. She lived in San Francisco.
She was in Daly City, wasn't she?
Well, she was originally in Daly City, and then she got sick, and then she went into a trailer up in Sonoma, and then in her last few years, she lived in an apartment on Clayton Street, right near USF in San Francisco. That's where she was living when she died. She was dead, but Kristen wanted to know what Lou Anne was like, but also she wanted to hear her voice because, as you know, actors like to be able to mimic the voice rhythms. Lou Anne had a little bit of a Denver accent. She was from the West. So I said, well, I have these tapes. I can bring them. And so what happened when I got up there, I played a lot of different tapes, but when I started playing the Lou Anne, which I hadn't listened to for almost 30 years. It had been locked up. There was a lawsuit. We won't go into that. But my own archive was locked up for like 15 years. I hadn't heard these tapes in 30 years. And I started playing the Lou Anne interview. It's an 8-hour interview. I was one of the few people that ever got to talk to Lou Anne because she had dropped out of the beat scene. And I started to realize, well, first of all, I saw other people coming around. Kristen was, of course, listening very intently because she was trying to pick up the voice and all of that. But I started seeing other people from the cast coming around, other actors, Sam Riley, Garrett, Walter Salles, some of the makeup people and the clothing. And pretty soon there was like a whole semicircle gathered around the tape recorder. And I'm looking and they all have this rapt expression on their face. And as I'm listening to this thing, I'm realizing she's telling the whole backstory of On the Road. I had totally forgotten this. Probably a lot of it had even gone over my head when I interviewed her. I was 28 years old. She was 47. She had had a full life. I was a young Catholic boy from Chicago. I mean, this stuff was going over my head. I'm listening to it now, and it's like she's telling everything about these people. Jack cried in my arms one night. And I realized there's a major story here that's never been told.
And an important story. And just one other question, though, about the boot camp and all that. Were they able to relate in a very deep way, in your judgment, to what you were telling them?
All of these actors had their own connection with the story. Kristen Stewart had read the book when she was 13 years old. Those of you who know about her know that she became a professional actress pretty much at the age of 12 or 13. She had to hit the ground running. She had to grow up very fast. When she read the book, she actually underlined the parts of Lou Anne. This is long before she ever had the role, because she saw in Lou Anne, a 15-year-old who marries Neal Cassady, goes to New York, meets all these world-class writers, a young woman who also had to hit the ground running, who had to become grown up and make very important decisions at a very young age. And Kristen thought, like, wow, this is a role model for me.
Well, so, I also read, didn't I, that she had a hard time understanding the acceptance of the cheating?
Well, yes, because, Kristen, as far as I know, has some very traditional values about man, woman, commitment, fidelity. And she couldn't understand. One of the first questions she asked me was, how could this woman keep loving Neal Cassady? He had all these other women. Was she just a chump? And I was trying to explain that Lou Anne was trying to pioneer actually some new roles for a woman, in the fact that maybe a woman can love more than one person.
I keep using the word woman. She was a girl, really. Well, she was jailbaited.
Well, she was a girl. She was 15 or 16, but she was also amazingly mature. You also have, if you read my, you've read my book, but the other people have to read my book, they will find out why Lou Anne was so mature. Her parents, she grew up during the Depression. Her parents split up because she was in Denver because of the economic pressure. She was sent to live with her real father in Los Angeles. At the age of 5, she had to ride the train back and forth between Denver and Los Angeles. Once or twice a year, this 5, 6, 7-year-old girl is riding the train. She has to grow up when she's just a little child. So, she did grow up. She had an amazing maturity for her age.
Talking with Gerald Nicosia, who, by the way, will be at Books, Inc. at Opera Plaza on Van Ness to sign his book later on this evening at 7 p.m. His book is
3 p.m.
I'm sorry. Thank you. One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. And this is a story that really is actually a pretty gripping story, especially for those of you who are fans of Kerouac or who know the story and were in one way or another fascinated by or infatuated, as so many were, by On the Road. Actually, before we get into her story, I'm just wondering there's been a lot of attempts to kind of maybe dismantle what I guess I would describe as or characterize as the myth of On the Road. Maybe that, you know, there was a lot of automatic writing, that it was written in a very short period of time, all of that. Can you weigh in here, since you're really sort of the putative expert of On the Road, in terms of how much of this is true?
Well, it's a very complicated thing, Michael, because he did type the book in 3 weeks, and he did type it nonstop, pretty much, very little sleeping. He was in a loft in Chelsea in New York with his second wife. She told me, she's dead now too, but I interviewed her, Joan Haverty. She said she had to make him pot after pot of coffee. He was sweating like a madman. He was hanging these sweaty T-shirts all over this big loft, another T-shirt, another pot of coffee. So he did write it in 3 weeks, nonstop. But he was using notebooks all these years when he was on the road. He was keeping little breast pocket notebooks. So as he was doing this nonstop typing, he'd just conveniently have these little notebooks open next to his typewriter. And yes, as we now know, since we've seen the manuscript, Jim Irsay owns it and ships it around the country and the world, you'll see millions and millions of little pencil corrections. So he actually did go over that thing and revise it. So it was typed very quickly, but it was using prior sources, and it also was revised.
And there is a portrait of Mary Lou, which comes across from your research and your judgment as having, well, not really a whole lot to do with, or certainly not a major amount to do with, the real person that you've tried to bring to life here again.
Yeah, she was portrayed really in a caricature fashion, and Kerouac had something to do with this. His female portraits are not that good. Those who love his work, as I do, and many people do, you know, the male portraits are great, the portrait of Neil, the portrait of Gary Snyder and Dharma Bums. The female portraits are very thin in Kerouac, and Luann, Mary Lou, is one of the thinnest portraits. She's portrayed as basically this young, blonde, beautiful sex bomb ditz with nothing in her head, and all she does is, you know, grab their organs as they're driving driving naked through the Southwest. In reality, she was, as I said, she grew up very young because of the struggle and the depression, the travels across country as a little child. You know, she saw a lot of pain and suffering. She's, in fact, when she was in Los Angeles, half of the class that she was in were taken to what do they call the camps for the Japanese, and she was because it was World War II, and she was very upset about that. She was like 12 years old, and she was protesting about why are they taking these people to these detainment camps. So this woman had a lot in her head. Very. Also very profound about people. She didn't have much schooling. She had to drop out young. But she had a very profound understanding of people. And that's where we can get into this. But she was able to bring Jack and Neil together.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that because that's the whole kind of fulcrum of your book, that she brought these two guys who didn't like each other together. And if they hadn't come together, there probably might not have been a book. There might not have been On the Road.
Well, one of the things that people don't realize is that Jack Kerouac, you know, we think of them together. We see the pictures of them together. You can see the Beat Museum in North Beach, and there they are standing arm in arm, 20 feet high. We always think of them, Jack and Neil, but they came from very different backgrounds. Jack Kerouac was bought into the system. He was, as I talked about myself, a good Catholic boy. He was from Lowell, Massachusetts. He was a good French-Canadian boy, loved his parents. He wanted to get ahead. His parents had put all the things into his head that you know, aspiring kids here everywhere. You've got to go to college. You've got to have a better life. You've got to make some money because we didn't. They were immigrants. They were French-Canadian immigrants. So when he went to Columbia, they had no money to send him. He was fortunately a great football player, and he won a football scholarship to Columbia. This was his chance to get ahead in life. He wanted to succeed. He wanted to be a successful writer and have the apartment, the penthouse, and the Cadillac. He was bought into the system and also be a good Catholic, you know, and marry and the family. Neil Cassady grows up on Skid Row, Denver. Okay, no mother around at all. His father's a wino. He at 5 years old, he's stealing the change off of news boxes. At 12 years old, he's stealing cars and taking women up to the mountains for sex. I mean, and he went to jail, to reform school. He went to what was close to a penitentiary at 18 years old. He had no investment in the system at all. So you bring these two guys together. They were both handsome, both athletic. They both respected each other. As Jack said in On the Road, we tiptoed around each other. But they didn't trust each other at all. And it was Luann, who loved both of them, who told Neil, well, Jack looks like this good Catholic mama's boy, but he's got a lot of profound questions about life. He's really ready to start experiencing things. And then she goes to Jack and she said, Neil looks like this jail kid, this kid that's just a wastrel, just robbing and using everybody. But he does care about people. He's got some profound thoughts. And she brings them close enough together to where they can begin to trust each other, which they didn't.
Talking again with Gerald Nicosia and his book, co-author with Anne-Marie Santos, is called One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. And Anne-Marie Santos, known as Annie Santos, is actually not only co-author, but the daughter of Lou Anne Henderson. I think we have her on the line here. Anne-Marie Henderson?
Yes.
Yeah, welcome.
Hello.
Join us, please.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Annie.
Hello. Hey, Jerry. How you doing?
Well, let's get the daughter's perspective here for a moment. This story has opened up for Jerry Nicosia, who, of course, is not only a Kerouac biographer, but really one of the lead beat historians. And did you know your mother had this kind of influence?
This has been a very educational experience for me as I've gotten older, because I really grew up fairly ignorant of her involvement. You know, it wasn't anything that was really talked about around the house. It wasn't common knowledge amongst, you know, my friends or even the adults that were around me as a child. My mother she was very private. You know, she didn't give a lot of interviews anyway. But that part of her life, I think she had kind of compartmentalized when she was younger, and she wasn't ready to expose me or to introduce me to that side of her life.
Well, how old were you when you first read On the Road?
I was well into my 20s.
Uh-huh. And
it was long after, you know, I didn't even know my mother had been married at that time. I knew she had married my father, but I met Neil at 16 years old. You probably got a little gist of it from the book that, you know, he came knocking on the door one day with this big bus outside, all kinds of people, and, you know, just, is Lou Anne here? And wild-eyed, pacing, no, well, you tell her, you know, I'm Neil Cassady, and I'm your mother's first husband. And it was just, you know, it was a surprise, it was a shock, and I was, you know, curious, but I was also kind of angry about, you know, what's going on here, what is this?
And this wild-eyed first husband that you knew nothing about, right?
Right, right. But she was, you know, she was a parent. And this was the 60s. We lived in San Francisco. Haight-Ashbury was going on. I was 16 years old. She wasn't about to give me any ammunition. You know, any parent is not going to say, well, you know, I got married at 15 and I left home and went to New York and was on my own. You know, she wasn't ready to tell me that story. She was still trying to keep me home and have a curfew by 1 o'clock. So she just gave me, you know, just the basic. Yes, I got married very young back in Denver. He was my first husband. We were married, you know, for a year or two, got a divorce, and then I met your dad and we married. And that was pretty much it. And I wasn't really interested. I was 16. I could have cared less. And Neil, that first impression of Neil, he was wild-eyed and crazy. It was like,
he didn't throw a hammer down, did he, when you met him? He's known for doing those kinds of things, those antics later on, in fact.
Right, right. So I was well into my 20s before she actually opened up. And it really started when more and more people were trying to take the time to interview her. The movie Carolyn Cassady was involved in was being filmed, and people were calling. And so, you know, she really just kind of was, you know, casual about it, so to speak. You know, she was like, yeah, you know, I did know in New York a writer. A friend of mine wrote a book about, you know, my first husband. But I was a kid. I wasn't that interested. I was, you know, I was doing my own thing at that time. And my mother was not, how should I put it? She wasn't the typical mother that I would have been surprised by any of this story. So a lot of the stories about the Beats and the travels, I kind of knew about, kind of out of context from the book and the writers. I knew she went to New York. I knew that, you know, she was in New Orleans with some people who were writers. But you hear stories from your parents. You hear you know, you hear talking and it goes in one ear and out the other when you're young.
Well, Annie, you said, you know, your mother owned a jazz club and you said all kinds of interesting people were coming through your house all the time, right?
Right. So it didn't stand out. The stories of going to New York or being around the writers didn't particularly stand out because my mother also, you know, immersed herself in her environment. She owned a jazz club. She had people in and out of the house all the time. She knew everybody in San Francisco from, you know, the mayor on down to street people. So we had a variety of colorful people coming through our house from a very young age. So for her to mention writers, and it didn't particularly stand out. It wasn't spotlighted.
We're talking with
well into my 20s and 30s.
We're talking with Anne-Marie Santos, who is the co-author of the recently published one and only The Untold Story of On the Road and daughter of Luann Henderson. I just want to get you on record here. Are you, I mean, notwithstanding all the characters you met when your mother ran the jazz club in North Beach and that came in and out of your house, are you bracing yourself to some extent for, I mean, with this movie and this book out, more focus and more attention, and how's that shaping up?
Well, actually, you know, I live in Virginia in a very quiet town, so I don't know how exciting it'll get, but it has been fun. It's been great meeting the kids, you know, Kristen and Garrett. Walter, who is very nice, and of course, you know, my experience with Jerry with the book has just been an education for me, and I have just really enjoyed opening up to this whole experience and seeing my mother from a different perspective, from looking at her, first of all, as a young girl. Most of us don't know the particulars or the very detailed lives of our parents. You know, everybody has a history. Everybody was a teenager once. Most parents don't tell their kids all of the details of growing up. I happen to get more and more detail as I'm being educated here. So it's been quite an interesting education for me because my mother was just such a role model for me, just a very independent, strong, loving woman. And this is really what made her the woman that she was to raise me.
Well, it's certainly been enlightening and educational to learn from you about your mother directly. I'm so glad you joined us here this morning,
thank
and
you.
I thank you for that. That's Anne-Marie Santos, who is with us from Virginia, co-author of the book One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road, written with Gerald Nicosia, who's here with us in studio, and will be at Books, Inc. later this afternoon, Opera Plaza on Van Ness, to sign his book later on at 3 p.m. You can join us, by the way, and in fact, if you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, you have questions or comments for Jerry Nicosia, beat historian and writer, and actually the biographer of Jack Kerouac. I want to put a plug in here also for John Antonelli's film, which I think was really a good film about Kerouac.
Yes.
But this film is going to be released later this month. I mean, the film that you did the boot camp with.
Yes, right.
Let me give the phone number and invite you to join us. In fact, we welcome your phone calls, so you can do that now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to join us. In addition to phone, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. And I'd like to hear from some listeners about, in retrospect, the influence and the impact of you that you might have had on Kerouac's novel, On the Road. As I said, certainly a Bible of the Beat Generation and a novel that has continued to generate interest and a great deal of excitement, as well as perhaps inspiration through the years. A lot of people are saying, oh, the Beat thing, that's yesterday, that's so Beat and everything. You may want to address that as well. I don't think so, especially here in San Francisco. But we'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road, that Bible of the Beat Generation, is a fictionalized account of Kerouac and his friend Neal Cassady's journey across the country. Also on that journey was Cassady's young wife, Lou Ann Henderson, fictionalized as the sexy Mary Lou, and Kerouac biographer Gerald Nicosia has now rescued Henderson from the margins of Beat scholarship in his book One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. We're talking with him about Henderson and her indelible impact on the friendship between Jack Kerouac and Neal Cassady and their story of being on the road, and inviting you, our listeners, to join us. Gerald Nicosia is here with us in studio, and we also spoke with his co-author, Anne Marie Santos, who was the daughter of Lou Ann Henderson, and you are welcome to join the program. If you have thoughts about On the Road particularly, we'd like to hear from you about its lasting legacy, or about Jack Kerouac and Neal Cassady, about the role of Lou Ann Henderson, feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment, or going to our Facebook page. And let's go right to Neal. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or any opinions of the various other few movies about the Beatniks, like Heartbeat, for instance. I'm particularly wondering if you've ever seen the TV show Route 66, which was originally intended as a TV version of On the Road. I understand Jack Kerouac liked to watch it and was kind of amused by it.
Well, actually, Jack Kerouac was very angry about it because he felt they had ripped off his book. And I mean, he actually came up with the idea of watching the white line running into the tires, and that was the opening shot. They picked two guys that looked like himself and Neal. He didn't get paid a cent for it, so he was very angry about that movie. But yes, it was very closely based, except that they had more money. They had a Corvette. It wasn't an old beat-up car.
Well, On the Road was the movie supposedly it couldn't be made. I mean, that was the pretty much the handle on it for years, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, originally in the 50s, Marlon Brando had been interested in it. Nobody could, and then, of course, Coppola got the rights about 1980. He started trying to get people to write scripts. Nobody could get a decent script because, you know, a movie's only 2 hours. It has to go from point A to point B, point C, point D. On the Road is these guys going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth across the country. There's really no plot line to it.
But the writing, too, was a challenge to try to bring that into cinematic form.
Yes, the magic of On the Road, a lot of it is in the writing. It's in the poetic prose of Jack Kerouac.
Burn, burn, burn like Roman candles in the night. Those lines stay in my head. I'm sorry, Neal, go ahead. Yeah.
Did you ever see Heartbeat?
Well, I was on the set of Heartbeat, actually. I wasn't an advisor to that movie, but I knew Carolyn Cassady, and I was down in Hollywood when it was being filmed. It's a horrible movie, and it's a shame because it had some really great talent in it. Sissy Spacek, John Hurd, Nick Nolte, but the script was horrible. The script was had none of the profundity. The thing about Jack and Neal is they're not just good-looking guys, you know, out to get laid, out to get drunk. They think. They talk about books. They talk about spiritual ideas. God, you know, we know God. Don't we, Jack? Neal says. But in that movie, it's like, you know, yeah, these two good-looking guys just trying to get some good-looking chicks. All of the depth, the profundity, the things that keep influencing people generation after generation were not in that movie at all. And that was the sad
thing. Did you like it, Neal?
Well, it was, I'll put it this way, it was better than nothing. It came closer to the Beats than the few other movies I'd ever seen on that subject, except maybe later on, The Last Time I Committed Suicide, which nobody went to see except me.
Okay, well, we thank you for the call. What do you think the real legacy is of the Beat Generation? Like I said, there's a lot of people who are flogging it and saying, you know, it's had its day and there are too many people nostalgic about it. I'm sure you've heard a lot of that kind of stuff. So what is the real legacy as you see it?
Well, I think that Kerouac and his message, the Beat's message On the Road, is needed more and more and more today. You have to understand that book came out of a period post-World War II when we had the first, propaganda had been developed during World War II by Goebbels in Germany. After World War II, you had this massive increase in advertising, putting out television ads. Hype, 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 forcing people to trying to get people to believe things that weren't true. On the Road came out of that in terms of a guy saying, let's get back to what's real. What's real is the human heart. What's real is how I feel about my friend. What's real is my desire to fulfill myself, whatever that is. It's not what church, state, Joseph McCarthy, all of Eisenhower, what these people are telling me. It's what's inside me. That message needs to be heard, and generation after generation wants to hear that message. That's why that, and now today we have even more, you know, massive control by the media of how people think. We need more and more to give us, read a book that tells us how to listen to our own inner voice. You can go back to Thoreau, but it's the same thing.
It's existential authenticity. I mean, yeah. That sounds like a fancy way to describe it, but that's certainly, I think, a good way to describe the legacy. But it's also very anti-materialism, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And again, I suppose that would be another reason why it's so valuable today, because, my God, what kind of an age do we live in? You have to have a Lamborghini and five houses in Marin. I mean, materialism, it used to be a million. When I was a kid, $1 million was the thing to aim for. Now you have to aim for $1 billion. Yeah, materialism is rampant. And this book is saying, again, you can enjoy life with 5 cents in your pocket, cooking some Chef Boyardee spaghetti over a fire with the woman next to you that you've been picking grapes with all day. That the joy there is far more than having the $5 billion in the bank.
Let's talk about for a moment. I want to go to a cut actually of Kerouac when he was on the Steve Allen Show, a famous appearance that he made later on. But talk about Cassidy and Kerouac later on, because Neil Cassidy winds up in Tom Wolfe's Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and I was joking about the hammer, but, you know, that always comes to mind. And there was a lot made of Jack Kerouac's, in the later days, his drinking, his conservatism, labeled a fascist even, I remember, because he was in favor of the war in Vietnam and all that kind of stuff. And it's a lot more nuanced than that, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. I mean, he grew up in a conservative milieu, a French-Canadian family. Lowell, Massachusetts, a very poor town where immigrants were glad to have jobs. They loved America. I mean, I'm Italian-American. My father used to put the flag out on every holiday. The poor immigrants loved America. This was the country that was giving their people a chance. Jack Kerouac was a pacifist. He didn't want to kill anybody. He laid down his rifle on the drill field when he was drafted into the Navy, but he still wanted to serve his country, so he joined the Merchant Marine, which was also very dangerous during World War II. Those ships were getting torpedoed all the time. He could have been easily killed, but he wanted to serve without killing, and he did. So he cared about America, and he cared enough to even risk his life for America. It bothered him, I think, in the 60s that there was so much. He did not support the war, and let's get the record straight on that. He counseled his nephew, Paul Blake, on how to avoid the draft. He announced on the air that the war was nothing but a conspiracy between the North and South Vietnamese to get American jeeps, and he wasn't so far from the truth on that one.
That's what I never heard.
He was not pro-war at all, but he didn't like the attacks on America. He didn't like the negativism. Jerry Rubin was screaming, kill your parents. Well, he loved his mother. Jack Kerouac lived with his mother till he died. So I think, that's a lot. And also the thing was that he felt rejected by the left-wing establishment. A lot of the critics of On the Road, there was a New York establishment, Norman Podhoretz. These people were saying that On the Road was a spokesman for thugs, that he was promoting juvenile delinquency. There were horrible, horrible attacks on the Road. He felt totally rejected. And so in some ways, he put on that protective armor of that mill worker, Lowell, working class background at the end of his life. Well, you guys don't think I'm a writer. Okay, and I'm just a mill worker from Lowell. And he would spout this stuff, but I don't think really believed a whole lot of it. But he did care about America.
And Cassidy became, he felt he had to live up to that myth that was created in On the Road?
I think in some part, yeah. Lou Anne talks about that in the book. That's a long interview that I did with her, which is printed verbatim in the book. She talks about the fact that On the Road was a double-edged sword for Neil Cassidy. In one way, it honored him because she said Neil couldn't have had a greater gift given to him than this man he loved, intelligent, brilliant man, Jack Kerouac, writing about him. But on the other hand, it froze him in time because, he at this young age, he was stealing cars and had all the different girls and stuff. But he wanted to be able to grow up and have a family and maybe go back to college. And he himself thought about becoming a writer. But instead, he had to remain, the fast, good-looking stud of On the Road, chasing girls, stealing cars. And yes, people wanted him to play that role, and it froze him in time. He couldn't grow beyond it.
Let's bring on a caller. David, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, where we pretty much live in the direct history you're talking about. And I just wanted to say that I think a natural progression from the beatniks to modern day leaves us with hip-hop as the direct descendant of the beatnik. I hadn't really heard anyone talk about that, but, I was at a show yesterday with Radioactive, who used to be with Spearhead. He's a great beatboxer, and he's teaching the kids that the heartbeat inside of their body is the very rhythm that we live by, and that when we get in touch with that rhythm, that inner heartbeat, that it can start to materialize around us into a world that is what we make it. And I think they both share that common thread that was woven maybe through the hippies into the 80s and somehow made it to modern day.
Well, you can go. You can trace a lineage. Beats, Jerry. I think this is fair to say. Beats to hippies to punk, and where are we now?
Well, the Beats. One of the big things the Beats did was to democratize literature, and writing, and art. Because in the 50s, you know, it was assumed that writing was a province of academia. You had to be a professor to write poetry, and you'd give a little reading, you know, in your professor's office to five people. The Beats were going back to Walt Whitman. They said poetry, writing should be for all the people, for the working man, for the common man, should be in language that everybody understands, that everybody can write poetry, and everybody can read their poetry to other people. It was bringing everybody into this big room of poetry. And, of course, that had, you know, many, many ramifications from spoken word and the poetry slams, hip-hop. We now understand that poetry deals with real issues, not the issues of, you know, 16th century England and the metaphysical poets. It deals with real issues, real people speaking the truth to other real people who can listen. So all of that came out of
the unacknowledged legislators, as Shelley put it. Let me thank David for the call. But there was also a definitely political side to that, which has evolved as well. And I'm talking, of course, about a lot of the dissent, a lot of the criticism of, the political structure of this republic. One not only thinks about Kerouac in this way, but Ferlinghetti, Ginsburg, really the poets of the Beat movement, who were quite critical of American political hegemony.
Yeah, they all felt that America had lost its heart, lost its kindness. Jack Kerouac always said he loved Depression America. Everybody was poor, of course. Nobody had any money. But therefore, people had to help one another. You had to help your neighbor because your neighbor didn't have any food. You had to bring him some groceries. He felt there was a community going on in the Depression era America. After World War II, everybody was prosperous, lots of jobs. Everybody now had the car, two cars and the two-car garage. But you didn't know your neighbor anymore. You didn't say hello to your neighbor. And, of course, there was this huge, you know, before World War II, America had basically tried to be an isolationist country, tried to stay out of world affairs. Post-World War II, America is now the major power in the world, you know, with a huge army, a huge standing army, and military outposts all over the globe. We're not a country that's concentrating on, you know, human cultural values anymore. We're concentrating on being this world power. And they felt this was a big mistake. All of the Beats felt that we had to get back to an America that cared about people again.
Again, if you just joined us, we're talking to Gerald Nicosia. His new book, co-authored with Anne-Marie Santos, is called One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. And I promised that we'd hear Jack Kerouac later on. You want to set this up for us a little bit, Jerry? He was on the Steve Allen Show. That was the last, last real appearance publicly, wasn't it?
Well, there probably were.
Major
There were a few more. And, of course, there was a terrible one on the Buckley Show in 68
where
he's fat and bloated and he's drunk on the show and everybody's making fun of him. But, he went from almost anonymity. I mean, his first book, The Town and the City, which was a good traditional novel, sold 400 copies and was put out of print immediately. And then for 6 or 7 years, he's writing these very innovative, jazz, nonstop novels, free flow, free association. Nobody's publishing them. And he was living in dire poverty. I mean, you know, he was lucky if he had $5 in his pocket. And suddenly On the Road is published, thanks to Malcolm Cowley. 30 publishers rejected that book. Malcolm Cowley, the great editor for Hemingway and Fitzgerald, forced, basically leveraged Viking and said, you've got to publish this book. It's published. It's a bestseller.
Sorry, I have to correct you. Malcolm Cowley wasn't editor for Hemingway and Fitzgerald.
Well, he knew them. He worked with them.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was a literary critic. In fact, he brought Faulkner back into the light.
But he was not an editor for them.
No.
Okay, all right. I'll take your word on that. But I thought he had some involvement with them. But he was somebody that had a great deal of prestige in New York because of his background, because of the writers he knew or had worked with. When he said to Viking, this is a major book, you've got to publish it, they had a lot of trepidation, but they said, okay, Cowley wants us to do it. Maybe we'll sell 5,000 copies. We'll do it. And overnight, the book becomes a bestseller and, you know, is not only a bestseller, but it's hailed in the New York Times as labeling a new generation, as defining a new generation. Kerouac is compared to Hemingway in the New York Times. Hemingway, lost generation. This man, Jack Kerouac, has now defined a new generation, the Beat generation. And so everybody wants him on television. And, of course, he's very handsome. He makes a good visual image. And suddenly this unknown person is getting put on major shows like the Steve Allen Show. And he was drunk on that show. He was so shy. He called himself a private Catholic mystic. He could not do public appearances unless he had a lot of alcohol in him. But he does read very well on the Steve Allen Show. He wasn't totally drunk. He was drunk enough to get over his shyness, but he was a beautiful reader of his work.
Well, let's hear a clip from that. This is Kerouac on that old Steve Allen Show.
Well, a lot of people have asked me why did I write that book or any book. All the stories I wrote were true, because I believed in what I saw. I was traveling west one time at the junction of the state line of Colorado, its arid western one, and the state line of poor Utah. I saw in the clouds, huge and massed above the fiery golden desert of Evenfall, a great image of God.
Well, there's that great image of God, mystic, Catholic, and it doesn't sound inebriated there, actually.
He was high enough to get over his shyness, but no, he was not in his bad, drunken, sloppy state as he was on the Buckley Show 10 years later. But you know, I want to say something about the Kerouac. When they promoted the book, it was very natural. You want to sell books, you promote it as this book's about sex, free sex, lots of beautiful girls, getting high, smoking pot. But there's a very deep spiritual dimension to On the Road. You know, at one point he said he's crossing the Great Divide and he sees God's finger in the clouds pointing, go thou and tell truly about man. There's always this old man who wanders by, you know, with a long beard on the road. And every time he sees this guy, he says, go moan for man, go moan for man, the suffering like Job, go moan for the suffering of man. So that spiritual side gets overlooked. But that is one of the things that gives this book enduring power and depth.
Here's a web comment from a listener who writes, recently I reread, after 30-plus years, both On the Road and Dharma Bums on Audible versions and concluded the same as Gerald Nicosia about the thinness of Kerouac's female characters. This is a good discussion and should help future generations discover these great works and chronicles of post-war 1950s America and understand social evolution of the times. And by the way, the narrations were great, and one was even done by an actor from The Sopranos, and that was John Ventana, the guy who played Artie Bucco, for those who know The Sopranos. Here's another listener. Robert says, could your guest discuss Neil Cassidy's association and influence on Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead?
Well, Neil, unlike Jack, Neil was able to make the transition to the 60s, to rock and roll. Jack was pretty much stuck in the bebop, the jazz, the 50s world. The 60s, Bob Dylan, all of that stuff was very foreign. Neil, you know, fueled up by amphetamine, he was going a mile a minute, and he met Ken Kesey, who became, of course, a real leader of the counterculture in the 60s. And Cassidy goes from being Kerouac's driver and On the Road to being the driver of the magic painted bus.
The
Merry Pranksters, Ken Kesey. And so through Neil Cassidy's association with Kesey, he met Jerry Garcia. He met the Grateful Dead. He was there at the acid tests. The Dead, I think they even have, don't they have one or two songs? Cassidy?
Yeah.
They have a couple of songs about Cassidy. He was a great figurehead for them because I think it was somewhat, it was important to these young revolutionaries to see that there could be older guys who were hip too. You know, that it wasn't, you know, you had this thing about don't trust anybody over 30, but Cassidy, people like Kerouac and Cassidy, but Cassidy, because he was there on site with them, showed them that, yeah, you can be older, but you don't have to be frozen, you know, this hidebound square. You can be somebody that's still going and learning. So Cassidy inspired them. This guy, you know, he's 40 years old, but he's going as fast as we are.
Another listener, John, writes, when I read On the Road as a teenager, I was shocked at Jack having all these children all over America not supporting any of them. What kind of man was he?
Wait, Jack having children all over America?
Jack
had one child, and unfortunately, no, he did not take care of her, Jan Kerouac. I did a book about her, Jan Kerouac, A Life in Memory.
Very little contact with her, in fact.
He only saw her twice. He didn't pay child support until they did blood tests, and the judge, they proved that he was her father, and the judge ordered him. And once they ordered him to pay child support, by the way, he did. Jan told me he sent the checks faithful every week.
It's interesting that listener would think, because Kerouac went all over America, that to use the Lawrence Ferlinghetti phrase, scattered his semen all over the country, making babies or something along those
lines.
Well,
in a way, you think he should have, but he did say somewhere that at some point they said that he had very low sperm count or something, because he should have actually, considering all the girls he had, he probably should have had a few more illegitimate kids. He did not, as far as we know. Cassidy did have a number of illegitimate kids.
But neither of them has a great record in terms of their paternity or their being fathers.
No, well, Cassidy at least tried. Let's say that for him. He worked on the Southern Pacific Railroad. He wasn't at home a lot, but he did pay the bills. He did spend a little bit of time. Jack spent no time with his daughter. I think that was one of the darkest parts of his life. And part of it was his total concentration on being a writer. He was, of course, he wasn't making any money, and that was part of it. When his wife got pregnant, he asked her to have an abortion. He said, this was after On the Road had been rejected 30 times, and he said, I can't make a living. Don't expect me to take care of a child. And she said, I don't want to have an abortion. I want this child. They split up. She had the kid. And then Jack's French-Canadian Catholic mother said, Jack, is that your kid? Because his mother was a devout Catholic. You have to take care of your child. So Jack said, no, Ma, it's not my kid. Mm. And he got stuck in that lie. But I think he agonized about it, because I heard, Michael, in later life, that with close friends like John Cleland Holmes, he would occasionally pull Jan's picture out of his wallet, hidden deeply in his wallet, and show it to people like John Cleland Holmes and say, this is my kid, with a very sheepish and guilty expression on his face.
Just a quick question that I've always held in the back of my mind. The name Moriarty for Neil Cassidy, did that have anything to do with Sherlock Holmes?
Well, Jack was an avid reader of Sherlock Holmes when he was young. Moriarty is the evil genius, of course. Neil was a genius, quite. And Neil was very much, you know, opposed to the establishment. Yeah, I think so.
Listener writes, a month ago, I moved onto a sailboat with my boyfriend. I had to give away nearly all my stuff, clothes, furniture, etc. At the time, I wondered, what the hell am I doing? But now that I've shed all my material belongings, I realize it's just stuff that weighs us down and distracts us. Now, every morning I wake up in my boat, I feel liberated and free, which is what On the Road constantly reinforced for me. Connor Oberst from Bright Eyes, a modern-day beat artist, sums it up well. My mind races with all my longings, but I can't keep up with what I got.
And Jack Kerouac, one of the most famous lines in On the Road is, the earth belongs to me because I am poor.
Well, you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Gerald Nicosia. And again, you can actually meet the author today over at Books, Inc. at Opera Plaza on Van Ness. He'll sign his book there at 3 p.m. and be there in the flesh. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. You're listening, again, to your public radio station, KQED. And I'm Michael Krasny. You're doing something now on Entesaki Shange?
Yes, I'm writing, we call her Zaki. I'm writing Zaki's biography, critical biography, which I'll deal with all her work as well as her life.
And where did you come from all your Beat Generation stuff? I mean, does she kind of flow out of that in some ways, or is it just a separate independent interest in her work?
Well,
she did for Colored Girls, by the way. That's her most famous work.
I mean, my degree is going way, way back to the University of Illinois in Chicago. I'm in literature. I've always been a poet. I'm a poet myself. I'm a writer. I love writing. I met her actually through the San Francisco literary scene because she began her work here. I didn't know her very early. She was here in 1974. She was giving readings at Specs Bar, and there was a place called Minnie's Can Do Lounge. She actually got her start in San Francisco. Then after she became famous on Broadway in her 20s for the play for Colored Girls Who've Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. She was, you know, world famous at 27 years old. She actually started coming back to San Francisco because she loved this city so much and giving readings here. And it was in a reading here, I think, in the early 80s, maybe 1980, 81, that I met her giving a reading with Jessica Hagedorn, who is another wonderful writer who came out of San Francisco. But I've known Zaki all these years. And a few years ago, you know, she has not been well for 6 or 7 years. She's had strokes. She's very unwell. And I said to her, you're a major American writer. Somebody should do your biography, because people also don't know that she's a novelist and a poet as well as a playwright. And she consented, said, you know, go ahead, Jerry, do a biography. And I'm having the time of my life because I'm meeting so many great people. She was deeply involved in the jazz world and many, many
worlds. I was going to make that point, that like Kerouac, there's really a definite kind of jazz quality to her work that's definitive in some ways.
Well, she married David Murray, who was one of the great jazz saxophonists of all time. And yes, she actually gave readings with many great jazz performers.
Listener wants to know if you've read Joyce Johnson's book, Minor Characters, about the female side of the Beat Generation, whom she was a girlfriend of Jack Kerouac's. In fact, and this listener, Eleanor, says, I found it very powerful.
It is a very powerful book. I find it very sad because it shows how difficult Jack had, what a difficult time Jack had in making a connection with women. In that book, Joyce Johnson basically said, you know, I just love this man. I would have done anything. He said, come to Mexico. I said, I'll come to Mexico. And then he leaves. He doesn't wait for her. He leaves before she gets to Mexico. You know, wherever she followed him, and he would run away. It was like, and he did that not just with Joyce, but with other women. Whenever the connection got too deep, he couldn't handle it, and that's one of the sad sides of his life. He could not sustain a connection with a woman, a loving woman. So it's a very good book, and it's a sad book.
As long as we're talking about women of the Beat Generation, I'll put a plug in for my former student, Brenda Knight, who I know is now your publisher, in fact, and wrote a book about the women of the Beat movement. which in the introduction says I was inspired by the venerable Michael Krasny's Course in American Poetry, and that word venerable has stuck in my head because I wasn't quite venerable then. I may be at least approaching venerable now.
I think you're venerable now.
Well,
Michael,
it connotes too much old in my mind, as well, you well know. But Brendan's book is really a good book.
It's a landmark book, yeah. There was no major book pulling all the beat women writers together, and there were many wonderful poets, and memoir. Memoir was also a big function for the women writers in exposing their role, because they were holding the beat generation together while all these guys like Cassidy are running around from city to city and girl to girl. Who's paying the bills? Who's raising the kids? Who's, you know, keeping connection with everybody? It was the women that were the glue that held the whole generation together.
Well, it's only that, but there was a tendency, of course, not to give as much recognition to women writers at that time. And Diane de Prima was should be recognized as a major figure in that whole canon work of that period, don't you think?
Diane de Prima, yes, is one of the major living poets in this country, no question. And, these guys were guilty. And many women have told me that as soon as, you know, if the guys were having a deep philosophical conversation and like a woman tried to jump in, they'd say, oh, can you go in the kitchen and fix us some food? I mean, they didn't want the women to contribute. They felt the women didn't have the ability to contribute. So it was, yeah, they were sexist, but of course they weren't lone sexist in those days. I mean, it was a pretty prevalent way of being.
It was a way of being. That's a good way to describe it. Should it disturb us at all, though, that Luann, as important as she is in this story and as much as you've fleshed it out, was so young?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Michael, because there's been some criticism of the book from the feminist left, saying, well, why are you writing this book? This woman was a chump. You know, she let herself be used by Neil Cassidy. But I don't see it that way. I think, you know, Luann makes choices all down the line. She loves these men. She wants to help them. She knows what she's going to have to put up with. But there's an interesting passage in the book where, you know, the first time they go to New York, she's really young. She's 15 or 16, and Neil's calling all the shots. The second time he goes to pick her up, she's engaged to be married to somebody else. And she said, okay, Neil. And now she's like 18 or 19. She says, I'll go with you for the fun. But this time I do what I want. If I want to go to bed with some guy, I'm doing it. It's going to be on my terms. And from that point on, she's making it happen so that she's getting what she wants to get out of the experience, too. So I don't see her as a chump.
Well, final long-awaited movie of On the Road, and Luann will be played by the vampire-famous Kristen Stewart. And just think about Jerry Nicosia there advising, because he was. His book, again, is out, co-authored with Anne-Marie Santos, whom we also heard from this hour. It's called One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road, and he'll be at Opera Plaza, Van Ness, to sign the book today at 3 p.m. We thank you for joining us in today's program. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zoll and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's Executive Producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.